support for The Trend on WNIN comes from members of the Local Programming Fund. I'm Micah Schweitzer. City-county government consolidations are relatively uncommon, but Vandenberg County voters will decide this fall whether to merge Evansville City and Vandenberg County government into one centralized entity. There's a hot debate raging. Some people are sure it's the best way forward. Others are just as certain it'll be detrimental to the city and the county. Today, we'll see what other consolidated communities can teach us. Matt Hanka teaches political science at the University of Southern Indiana. His specialty is urban politics and policy and housing and community development. And welcome. Good to have you on the show today.
Thank you, Micah. It's a pleasure to be here.
And, you know, we have seen when you look at yard signs, you look at websites, you look at the debate that the community forum that took place on Wednesday evening, that there is a real impasse between the yes and the no camps on this issue, largely because you can't compromise on this. I mean, either we're going to vote for this or we're going to vote against it. But I was struck by the fact that you have both sides saying the exact opposite on certain issues. And of course, they can't both be right. I mean, for instance, that taxes will go up and taxes won't go up. One of those can't be true.
Right, right. The idea that a lot of those that advocate for consolidation want to promote issues of efficiencies and effectiveness. And oftentimes when you have efficiencies, you're streamlining certain services and functions. And that may be a result of reducing costs, but a lot of the empirical analysis and evidence has suggested that when you try to consolidate, that you're not seeing any noticeable decrease in costs or even necessarily decrease in spending.
So what's the benefit if you can't guarantee that?
A lot of the benefits are a little bit more than just the taxes and how much taxes would cost or even service delivery. A lot of the benefits come out of the idea that you bring two governments together that can increase a region's economic development profile and even financial stability, if you will. And sometimes those discussions get promoted by those that favor consolidation and sometimes ignored or sometimes overlooked by those that are against it because they're looking more or less at their parochial interests.
And you have looked at other cities, and I guess, I mean, that is, as far as I'm aware, the only way one can try and predict anything is by looking at what other cities have done. Are there any other predictive tools out there?
A lot of times, I think when analyzing city-county consolidation, the case study method is very, very useful. And a little bit of the problem is we just haven't had enough of these. Since 1947, we've had fewer than 30 consolidations take place, so meaning the voters approved or it was approved to go into an act. And we've only had four within the last 50 years of cities greater than 250,000. So of those that have happened, four have been of relatively large cities. And we've seen some others that are smaller cities, such as Lexington, Fayette County, Kentucky, Athens, Clark County, Georgia, and then Kansas City, Wyandotte County, Kansas. As a matter of fact, a lot of people got to hear about those experiences Monday and Tuesday here in town.
And there were radically different interpretations of the message that that was brought when the former mayor of Kansas City, Kansas, visited.
Right, in a way. And a lot of times, the messages that are sent with the different kinds of consolidations, a lot of it is based upon scale. That larger cities that consolidate, there have not been any noticeable increases in efficiencies. But there have been studies that have shown, and Richard Condry did a study of Athens, Clark County, Campbell and Side, and did another study of the merger, that there were some benefits, that you did see decrease in financial and government expenditures. And a lot of it is looking at scale. So sometimes I think what we're seeing is we're seeing the proponents look at the Louisville model, and in a way it's comparing apples and oranges, because Evansville, Vandenberg County, Evansville is less than twice the size of the old city of Louisville. You combine Vandenberg County is close to one-fourth the size of the combined Jefferson County. And so a lot of the literature and a lot of the analysis has suggested the four major consolidations of Louisville, Jacksonville, Nashville, and Indianapolis, there hasn't been an impact on efficiencies. Indianapolis and Nashville have had some impacts, but maybe they've had impacts because of other other considerations such as, you know, developing more of an amenities economic development strategy. Amenities meaning with Nashville evolving to become Music City USA, with and Indianapolis becoming a center of amateur sports. But it's amazing that all three of the four city-county consolidations, except Louisville, all have professional sports teams.
And so that changes
the It changes a lot of it because if somebody out in the county is worried about their taxes, a lot of times, yes, they might not be the constituency that's a part of that growth machine, the idea of all those interests coming together to promote economic development. But a lot of times it does have an impact on the region.
So can we learn anything useful from looking at other cities?
We can. We can look at it from a lot of the way they decided to combine services. But we can also look at the impacts on economic development as well. But we can also look at how they also came together to rescale the government. Part of how Louisville's experiment had a lot to do with two failed merger attempts in the 80s. And then in 1986, the mayor of Louisville, Jerry Abramson, went into an agreement with the county judge of Jefferson County to create a city-county compact that didn't rescale or reconfigure the territorial boundaries, but it developed what we call these joint power agreements. So certain functions were merged already. So that may have given Louisville a little bit of a heads up or a little bit more of a comfort level, even though it was contentious debate and it barely passed in 2000. Some of those have gleaned, and I'm not sure if Evansville looked at some of what the city-county compact did or if there was even a possible alternative to not rescale our government, but maybe pursue these sort of linked functions.
So when you look at a total of 30 consolidations over the past 65 years, four of them with big cities, are there any trends that you can actually define?
With respect to the smaller ones, a lot of it is simply just trying to promote better efficiencies, promote effectiveness of delivery of public services, as a way of just being able to make government more efficient. And a lot of that was pushed for that. Some looked at efficiencies, other looked at how can we reduce the costs and how can we better enhance services? Because often we see with how cities and regions evolve, where a lot of people are moving out into the suburbs. And by having them moved out in the suburbs, they might be establishing their own towns and special districts. And then from there, they can create their own local governments. And a lot of that is based upon this notion that called vote with your feet. Charles Thiebaud, an economist, came of this idea that because people are rational maximizers, they are going to do what they can do to maximize their self-interest. And they're going to move around and find the locales that best fit their preferences. And that's happened. And a lot of that happened after World War II. We saw the boom of suburbanization. We got these localities moving, but then how do we address the problems as a metropolitan government? Some have decided to rescale and consolidation. Others have done the link functions, and others have done more of a regionalist approach. And sometimes that's difficult because you've got different cultures and different entities trying to solve one problem. Does a big box consolidated government solve the regional problems? It just depends on a lot of it, how the territory is scaled in the first place.
And so we fall sort of somewhere in the middle between these smaller mergers and the big ones.
We fall into that. And one of the things of some of the mergers that have happened with Louisville, for instance, there was in the county, there's a lot of different, what they call fourth, fifth, and sixth class incorporated entities. Mm-hmm. And part of the compromise of the merger referendum was to allow them to maintain autonomy. Even though they drew single member district lines that incorporated their population, they still retained their autonomy. And Jacksonville, Duval County, Florida was one big entity. Indianapolis had a couple of towns.
And the word for that locally here is Darmstadt. And we can talk about that in a minute. We're talking with Matt Hanka from the University of Southern Indiana. This is The Trend. We'll have more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Support for WNIN comes from Evansville Day School, presenting Discover the Upper School Difference, a program to assist parents and students considering high school options. The October 24th program at Evansville Day School features dinner, tours, and a chance to meet the faculty. Information on scholarships and financial aid will be available. Learn more at 476-3039 or evansvilledayschool.org. And from the Evansville Philharmonic Orchestra, presenting opening night, Bolero, featuring classical guitarist Anna Vitovich performing Rodrigo on Saturday, September 29th at 7 p.m. at the Victory Theater. Ticket information at 812-425-5050 or evansvillephilharmonic.org.
You're listening to The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Later in the show, we'll talk with the co-author of Half the Sky, Cheryl Wu Dunn. Right now, we're discussing city-county government consolidation with University of Southern Indiana political science professor Matt Hanka. And you were talking about incorporated entities that are separate from the main city in a region, and Darmstadt is that case here in Vandenberg County. This doesn't change, this would not in some way disincorporate Darmstadt if this plan goes
into effect. No, Darmstadt has its own sovereignty, and it's in it. And in the plan, there's a town service district, and the town service district, you know, nomenclature in the plan means Darmstadt. Jacksonville Duval County, the example I was giving before, it's a pure consolidated entity, and that's even among the ones that have done it before, that's unlikely because you still have to deal with those municipalities that are within that county. And I think a lot of these acts kept that in mind. So a lot of the fact that in Louisville, if you were one of these 93 fourth, fifth, and sixth class cities, you maintained your autonomy, but you still benefited from the idea of being in Louisville Metro. And you for instance, St. Matthews is one of those. That's actually one of the relatively larger cities outside the old city, and they have a fire and they have police and they have a city council that makes decisions. And, you know, and those that lived within in the old city, they called it the urban services district. And in many ways, that's the plan is using that. If the old city of Evansville is the urban service district, everything outside of it is the general services district. But Darmstadt,
in terms of trash collection,
in terms
and
of
water
that,
and sewer and all that sort of
right,
stuff.
Right. And a lot of that is based on maintaining. And some would argue, would say, well, okay, if you've consolidated your territory, but you still give them names, okay, some can make an argument, well, what's the point of having rescaled and reconfigured your government in the first place? What one thing that Louisville did that you're not seeing a lot of with Evansville and Vandenberg County is the push towards putting themselves as a major player in the region. So a lot of the sell with Louisville was we were going to become the 16th largest city in America. I'm not sure if I'm hearing it from the yes folks of this profile, even though a lot of the people who are supporting consolidation and unification believe in much of those same things. And it's going to be your players. And a few minutes ago, I talked about what the growth machine is. And those are folks that are consisted of the major supporters are your Chamber of Commerce, Chamber of Commerce, Southwest Indiana, Evansville Courier and Press, the newspaper, a lot of the business groups, the League of Women Voters, civic organizations that are a part of the media in particular, that are a part of helping to promote a development agenda, especially a pro-growth agenda in the downtown. And a lot of this doesn't take away from that. A lot of times you can have a consolidated government and still have a strong central city. It doesn't mean you've essentially given into the suburban interests or somehow suburban interests have taken over. You know, if you're a suburb, you can't be a suburb of nothing.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
So you still have a city
exactly.
there.
You've got to have the herb.
You've got to have the herb. And a lot of this, it's, you know, so people live in the city, you don't have to worry about, oh, well, if I'm in the county, all those interests or vice versa. There's, you know, you have to maintain strong urban center cores.
Now, you mentioned regionalism. And so while what we're talking about might seem primarily of interest to people who live within Vandenberg County, what is the potential impact of something like this on you know, the Gibson and Henderson and Warwick counties of the region?
It's wonderful because if you have a consolidated government, you have a larger, stronger entity. And that is something that perhaps potentially could become a major force in trying to produce regional arrangements or regional cooperation. Some people who are opponents to consolidation say you don't even need to have a consolidation. The governments maintain in place. You just create a structure of, sometimes they call it multi-tiered government, mm-hmm. where you have, and this is a case in Miami-Dade County, Minneapolis-St. Paul, where you have a regional authority that handles all of the cross-regional issues, and then you still maintain local government autonomy that takes care of what I call the labor-intensive services, police, fire, and sanitation. Just because you consolidate doesn't, you know, mean that you can't produce a regional framework. A council of governments is a new type of approach that could happen, where you have, you know, a number of governments throughout the region in one common entity.
But there was a point made recently by members of Citizens Opposed to Reorganization in Evansville, or CORE, pointing to growth statistics surrounding Indianapolis, for instance, where the surrounding counties, the suburban areas around Marion County, have been booming with significant growth and much more stagnant growth within the city itself. And I mean, is that related to consolidation? Is that an argument against what you're saying could happen?
I'm not sure my answer was specifically to consolidation. A lot of times that's simply just you're moving out where taxes are lower and land is cheaper, and that's back to the TIBU. People are going to want to live where they can get the most quote-unquote bang for the buck, mm-hmm. and move out of that. And I'm sure a lot of the critics of consolidation would say, oh, consolidation doesn't do anything to solve that. I don't know the specifics of Indianapolis, Marion County, but sometimes that's just a consequence of just growth out in the suburbs.
So, but could that be because consolidation made living within Marion County and within the city of Indianapolis more expensive?
I'm not sure if I can answer with Indianapolis and Marion County, but it's possible that with Indianapolis, Marion County, they established a Republican power base for a number of years that kept taxes and services low. With Evansville, Vandenberg County, people are moving out, but it's a different kind of scale, because you can be way out in the suburb, way out in the county, or way outside Evansville, mm-hmm. and you're still in the county, and you're still a part of that.
Whether it's more rural area,
it's more rural area, and that's back to the apples and oranges. You are trying to consolidate entities that there's a lot of potential growth out there, and perhaps maybe this is proactive. We want to capture the growth that's out there for the people that are moving out there. But to the regionalism question, there has to be discussions of how, I mean, this is a very diverse and robust region, and for having Evansville as a stronger player in that region helps. And if consolidating the government is a solution, it has its benefits. I mean, the empirical analysis suggests that it doesn't, or it's limited, negligible effects. But from an economic development standpoint, especially in smaller scale cities, those are there's been some positives. I mean, we saw that even in Louisville with some of the financial strength there.
A lot of the argument, we just have a couple of minutes left, but a lot of the argument that we've heard from both sides revolves around taxes and representation and issues like that. What are we not looking at? What in, you know, as somebody who has studied this issue in other communities, what should we be weighing and discussing that we're missing out on?
I think some of the discussion that's being missed is the equity issue. We in this debate, a lot of the debates that have been in the four major consolidation platforms hasn't focused on the issue of the dilution of minority representation. One of the opponents to a consolidation reorganization has been the Reverend Adrian Brooks, and he represents a constituency. And in many ways, there's an alliance with them in CORE, but CORE is speaking to different those issues of taxes. But a lot of the dilution of minority representation is a major consequence of rescaling and consolidating, because you have entities where, and it may not be that much of an issue, but it ought to be. And even if we don't have our minority representation in our current structures low, there's been effects. So you had in the case of Louisville, they had a board of aldermen of 12. Four of the 12 were African American. They decided to rescale with 26 districts, and six of those are majority African American districts. So that diluted the minority representation. That's not quite getting discussed, because if you go back to these issues, and we've talked about efficiencies, effectiveness, and economic development, but a lot of the equity issues, you know, a lot of this has to stem with power. And that's what a lot of the literature talks about. The scholars who study the Louisville case have talked about issues of power, that this is about it. Not that that issue is lost on those opposing it, but when you're rescaling a government to become one, you have a stronger, more powerful entity. Mm-hmm. And if you have that, those that have had a part of say to seat at the table, their position may, their voting strength and their power may be significantly threatened or reduced. And not hearing a lot of that in the discussion.
That's Matt Hanke. He teaches political science at the University of Southern Indiana with a focus on urban policy and politics. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here. Thank you.
You're listening to The Trend, and associate producer Tony Voss joins us now for our mid-show B segment.
It's time to drop some science with our biology expert, Dr. Katie Winsett from USI. This week, we are talking about quite possibly the strangest flower you will ever have heard of.
The Titan arum is in the same family, the Araceae family, as the peace lily and the calla lily. And so they're all in that same family.
Okay, and whereas those are, you know, the typical size we think of flowers, the Titan name is not just a clever advertising ploy.
No, it really is a large flower. The tip of the spadix can be 6 feet in the air, and the flower can, you know, be 3 feet in diameter, the spathe. So the what we would think of as the petal part could be 3 feet in diameter.
The other thing about these and why a lot of people might be familiar with them is that they're notorious for smelling really bad.
Yes, they are also called the corpse flower because they release an odor that smells like rotting mammal flesh. It's not a very polite smell.
The reason it makes this smell has to do with basically the way it attracts...
Pollinators. Right. So a flower produces pollen, and pollen is transported to a female flower in order to pollinate a flower to make seeds. Many flowers use insect pollinators. We think of bumblebees. But the Titan arum is going to use flies and beetles and things that are attracted to this the nasty rotting smell.
And the reason that we're talking about this particular flower is because you actually are in possession of one.
Yes, I am. I was gifted with a tuber, which is like the dormant phase that's going to grow into the leaf or the flower. I was gifted with a tuber over the summer from the University of Washington in Seattle. And so I have it growing in the greenhouse at USI.
The tricky thing about these seems to be that you mentioned the flower and the leaf. There are really two different ways that it can grow, and you don't know which one's going to be.
Right. When we think of a plant, we often think of a stalk that has leaves, and then a bud is going to form, and you'll see the flower. And these work in two different phases. So we have the vegetative phase, and then we have the flowering phase. And the vegetative phase produces a leaf, but no flower. And the leaf can die back, and then a flowering phase can occur that only produces the flower. So we have two different phases in the way that it grows. I don't know which phase is coming out of the tuber right now. I think it will be the vegetative phase, where we'll have a leaf for the next year, and it will die back, and the next time it grows, it'll either be a leaf or a flower. I have no way to predict.
Right, and these don't alternate.
Right. It's not 1 year this and 1 year that. It can be years before you see a flower. I could get the leaf to come up for the next 2 years. I could, the next two cycles, three cycles, four cycles, and then a flower. It might never flower. There's no way to predict.
We talked about the flower stage. There's also a leaf stage, but we don't want to get the wrong idea that this is just a leaf like we'd see on a tree. This almost looks like a tree itself.
Right. The vegetative phase produces something that does look like a small tree. It can be 6 feet tall. It can be larger than a person. But in reality, it's one single leaf. And what happens is you have the leaf blade, and then it produces leaflets. So it's all the same leaf, even though it looks like a stalk with leaves coming off of it. But it's still a single leaf. So it's botanically quite interesting.
So if you were to like bisect the stalk looking part of this, it would look inside. It wouldn't look like a tree that you would maybe cut open.
Right. It's not going to have rings or wood. It's not woody.
Mm-hmm.
It's all vegetative.
This isn't the type of thing that you can very easily go out and find information on how best to take care of it.
Right. I've been most recently in contact with the Missouri Botanical Garden. They had two of theirs flower this past summer. And so I called them up. I called the horticulturalist and asked, how do you keep yours? Because obviously they were successful in getting a flower, to talk about soil and fertilizer and watering and all of those practical things for keeping a plant.
All right, so they had a couple of them, but this is not a plant that's native to this area or even to this climate.
Right. The Titan arum is actually native to Sumatra, and that is the only place where it grows in the wild. Native to the tropical climate, but even in our tropics, Central America, South America, you don't find them growing in the wild. They're only native to Sumatra. So everyone that we have in the United States is growing in a garden, a botanical garden or a greenhouse.
And in your case, you're growing it in a greenhouse, mm-hmm. trying to regulate it to, I guess, mimic what it would get?
Yeah, that's the idea. You know, if it grows in the wild in a place that is tropical climate, which means a little wetter than here, a little warmer steadily than here, then that's the conditions it needs to grow. So the greenhouse stays in the low to mid 80s year round, and then I keep the soil moist. I don't want to overwater it, but you don't want it to dry out either because it's native to rainforests. Trial and error, and hope not very many errors.
I've given you sunshine. I've given you dirt. You've given me nothing but heartache and hurt. I'm begging you sweetly. I'm down on my knees. Oh, please grow for me. I've given you plant food and water to
sip. It's always good to get some little Shop of Horrors in. Be sure to check out the Trends Facebook page, where we've got more info on the Titan arum, including some pictures of the progress Katie's plant is making. It is not quite yet at the blood-drinking stage. Thanks, Micah.
Thanks, Tony. This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. A growing chorus of voices, including Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, are calling gender inequity the moral challenge of this century. One of the first people to voice that challenge is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Cheryl Wu Dunn. With her husband Nicholas Kristof, she co-authored an urgent and moving account of the existential challenges facing women. It's called Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. Cheryl Wu Dunn, welcome to The Trend.
Oh, my pleasure in being here.
And I want to start with this rather shocking idea of gendercide, that between 60 and 101 million women are just missing from the world population.
It's pretty stunning. I think I was very skeptical at first when we started looking into this, because to be able to say that this is the moral challenge of a century, that's a huge statement. But as we looked further, not only did we see some horrific examples of this with our own eyes, but also we came across some statistical conclusions by Amartya Sen, who is a Nobel Prize-winning economist, and he and his demographer colleagues discovered that there were anywhere between 60 million and 100 million missing women from the current population, missing females from the current population. And so how did this happen? Well, yes, there might be some underreporting, but also there are probably female fetuses who are aborted before they are even born. But also there are girls who are, and women who are discriminated to death. So in a place like India, for instance, girls between the age of 1 and 5 have a 50% higher mortality rate than boys.
You've shown a very disturbing image of a young girl who is severely malnourished, and in many ways, it's like many pictures one sees of malnourished children, but her brothers are completely fed.
Well, that's what's stunning, is that within the same family, the discrimination takes place to that extreme. So it's not as though the entire area is malnourished. It's that the parents made choices. They decided that the food and the resources should go to the males.
There seems to be a misconception that the population worldwide and in most countries is really 50-50 or maybe even, you know, 51-49 in favor of women. And what you're finding is really not.
Well, the reason is that in a place, in places like Europe, in the U.S., where men and women, boys and girls, really have equal access to health care, nutrition, and food, yes, there are more women because we do live longer. But when you go to the developing world, that is not the case at all. And adding to those statistics is probably maternal mortality. There are many women who die in childbirth, giving childbirth. They actually die because, not because they don't have certain technology, but simply because there's no political will to let them go to visit clinics.
I want to come back to that question of political will a little bit later, but it sounds like the period from conception through the very first years of life are the most precarious for girls. And then, of course, the childbirth period, which is connected to that for mothers then.
Well, it's actually interesting. It depends on where you're looking. In a place like India, the age between 0 and 1, baby girls and boys survive at the same rate because they're often fed by the breast. And the breast really doesn't show a son preference. But as I mentioned earlier, in India, from the age of 1 to 5, girls die at a 50% higher mortality rate because often they're just not vaccinated. They don't get the vaccines that we, you know, that most children get around the world. And if they are sick, they probably aren't taken to the clinic until it's just too late.
You talk about this being the moral issue of the century, which, as you said, is a big statement to make, and one you have to be careful in making. And I wonder about the issue of culture as an excuse for some of what goes on across the world, not just in developing countries, but in all countries, where we have to be careful to say what is right and what is wrong in another culture. And maybe is there almost an overreach of political correctness that can happen where we say, well, that's just how it's done in X country?
I think that's absolutely right. In fact, it seems as though when you actually look at some of the practices that take place in these cultures that we're talking about, let's say in female cutting or circumcision, chances are that if you know, with your cultural sensibilities, if you feel that it's very offensive, chances are that there is someone locally who also feels it's very offensive, but just is too afraid to voice it. There is a constituency, usually locally, that opposes it, but they just can't give voice to it because they would just be crushed. So there are some organizations that are the Western, you know, funded organizations that are working with local organizations to help give them resources, skills, advice, money, so that they can actually carry out what they think is, you know, trying to eradicate a practice they think is just barbaric and doesn't belong in this century.
How do you walk the line between giving aid to a country, Western aid to, say, a developing nation, and not creating a dependency or a sense of superiority? I mean, we've got the money, we've got the resources, we've got the know-how. Now you listen to us and we'll show you how to live.
Oh, excellent question. In fact, aid, we are developing really more sophisticated approaches to aid. I mean, I think that USAID is much more wise to how to not create a cultural dependency on aid. And so it's teaching people how to fish and not giving them the fish. In terms of food aid, for instance, we used to just like drop boxes of food, but that's not great because it puts the local farmers out of business if they're the ones trying to grow the food and sell it in the local marketplace. And then, you know, the local people, as soon as, you know, a hunger, you know, something happens with the food, then, you know, they get it free. And then why should they buy it on the marketplace? So it does create a lot of problems that they are really now beginning to understand and trying to change their approach.
Another dependence-related question that I have is, you've mentioned how empowering it has been for many Chinese women to find work in factories, and yet that's dependent on American consumerism. Isn't there a problem there?
Oh, actually, thank goodness for American consumption, right? In fact, that is one way that we all are becoming much more globally interdependent. It was very critical for the U.S. to buy a lot of Chinese goods because that actually kept a lot of these women employed in these factories. It also has given incredible life to the Chinese economy. And now they're looking inward and trying to create their own local consumption. If that could only happen in other developing countries, in Africa, if there could be an industrialization of Africa where perhaps then China will move up the economic ladder and they won't make the cheap clothes. Maybe we will someday be buying cheap clothes from Africa.
And so it sort of moves around and then eventually everybody's standard is raised, you're saying?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if they can produce cheaper clothes that are of equal quality or just as good quality as those made in China, then perhaps Americans will start buying clothes from Africa. And, if they can make them cheaper, then maybe that also improves the standard of living for Americans because they can buy more clothes with the budget that they have.
But this seems to be a complex issue because one hears a lot of troubling stories about exploitative labor. Women, for instance, are paid less than their male counterparts in factory work. If you're saying somebody has to make the cheap goods, isn't that somebody, even if it's raising them out of poverty, aren't they still in a tough situation?
You have to look at the context. So, for instance, it certainly by our Western standards, they are making very, very below market wages. And, you or I certainly would not want our kids working in those factories. However, you do need to look at the alternatives that these people have, the women have. And so if there are better alternatives, they will seek them. So that's why the market works. If they can find better, higher-paying jobs, then they won't take the jobs in the factories that don't pay enough. And so if those factories want those women to work there, they will have to raise their wages. So it's the market principle. And, obviously, you have to look at the working conditions. And in China, they have gone through a process where they have been criticized and there have been fires where people have been killed. It is a process. The U.S. went through it many, many years ago, hundreds of years ago, and now China's going through it, and I'm sure it will be the same for other developing countries.
We're talking with Cheryl Wu-Dunn. She's the co-author of the book Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. And I want to ask you about that second half of the title, Turning Oppression into Opportunity, that there's a direct correlation. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, from our point of view, women really are not just the victims. They might be a victim at one time, but if they're saved, they can actually become part of the solution. And in the book, we talk about many times where women who have just had the opportunity, they will astound you. They can become entrepreneurs. They can become midwives. They become nurses at hospitals. It's just when they're given the chance.
So much of the book is personal stories, too. Is there a reason for that?
Well, we think that the way to explain how things really work on the ground is to tell stories that we've seen. And I think that was very, very helpful in bringing to home to the reader just exactly how it works with individual stories of people.
That numbers are too much. I mean, you say 60 to 101 million women are missing.
You need
it
both.
It boggles the mind, right?
You need both. You really do need both because I do think that some people do think that if you just tell stories, they're saying, well, that's one in a million, you're not telling me the whole picture. So you need to support it with statistics. But I think to really bring home, in someone's mind in a way that they will remember, it will sear into their memory, is when you tell the individual stories of the women that we've seen, and they're horrific stories, but they're also heroic stories.
I love the story of a girl whose family got a $120 goat, and she wound up with a U.S. college degree.
Absolutely, Beatrice Bira. And she is a very interesting woman. She was born in Uganda near the Congo border and very, very poor. And her parents did not want to send her to school because they said, well, you're going to be lugging water every day, and why should we pay the school fees for you? So they didn't put her into school, and she was 9 years old and had never set foot in a school. Then there was a small group in Connecticut called the Niantic Community Church. They made a tiny donation to Heifer International, who sent two goats to Africa. One of them landed with Beatrice's parents. So the goat had twins and started producing milk. And so they diverted some of that milk to the marketplace and started selling it for cash, which meant they got enough cash so that they could start sending Beatrice to school. But she was a brilliant student. She went on to actually win the first person in her village a scholarship to study in the United States. And so she has, yes, graduated from Connecticut College. It's a real dream of a story. And she's actually now working in the field of development because she wants to give back. It's an example of her becoming part of the solution, not the problem.
Hmm. You know, I want to quote something that Stephen Colbert said to you when you were on the Colbert Report in 2009. He made this quip, "You're being pro-lady, let me be pro-man," in his inimitable way. But there's a good question in there, and that is, how do you convince men that women's issues are men's issues too?
Oh, absolutely. And that is critical because they're social issues. The only way you change social attitudes is by working with both men and women. And the other thing is that what surprised us is often the perpetrators of evil are not men. They're women doing this to other women.
You're talking about like sex trafficking,
for instance. The brothel owners are often women, and the violence, the brutality that they inflict on the girls are done by them. They don't call in the thugs to do it. They often do it themselves. So that's what's pretty stunning. And so it really is men and women having to work together. And often when a woman actually becomes an entrepreneur, who benefits the entire household. So it's the man, the husband, who benefits as well.
We've talked a lot now about the developing world. Is this a developing world issue? What about the U.S. and gender inequality?
Definitely there are problems everywhere in the world. We chose to focus on the developing world because the order of magnitude of the brutality is just, you know, much more intense. However, there are problems everywhere. There are problems in our backyard, and we do need to address them as well. It's hard to go overseas and say, oh, we want to help save you. And then, of course, we have problems, the same problems in our own backyard. So, yes, we need to address both. It's not a matter of choosing. It's just, yes, we need to address both. And in fact, when you find ways to solve problems in any place of the world, any part of the world, often you can bring them back home or apply them somewhere else. So we are learning from wherever we are trying to solve these problems.
You mentioned the issue of this taking political will. In fact, in the book, you say that's all it takes is political will, and we will solve this issue. But if we look at like a class photo of the U.S. Congress, you see a bunch of older white men. Can you really have the political will to change systems, like such entrenched systems of gender inequality, when you don't have real representation of people on the ground?
That's a really good question. I think that one example of how it can work, and it's just a start, is that President Obama himself announced a global trafficking initiative on Tuesday. And we think that that is the beginning. It's when politicians know that they have to listen to their constituents. And so if their voters say, you know, this is an issue we care about, then they're going to have to listen, and they're going to have to vote on a particular measure that comes up in the House or the Senate and say, you know, yes, I did. And they have to answer to their voters. So I think that it really is important for everybody to be aware of this issue, at how it happens at home and abroad. And that's the way we can get politicians to start legislating policies.
I want to ask you a bit of a broader question, more about what you do. And that is, you've been on, it seems from my research, every talk show, you know, on the list. And it seems like when you go on, you get asked a lot of the same questions. I'm asking the same questions that somebody else asked, you know, a couple weeks earlier. What do you wish you would be asked?
I just wish that someday that we could be asked a question about, okay, now how much more resources do you need for this problem everywhere in the world? Because I think that once everybody recognizes that it's a problem, people will then just start figuring out the best way to solve it. There are already lots of ways to solve it, but we want better ways. We want more resources. And we are already hearing about more people going into this. There are talented students who are going into this field, which is fabulous. It wasn't like that 10 years ago. So I think the trend is really positive, but it would be nice for people to start throwing resources at it. So we can say, oh, we've got so much, we don't know where to put them.
So that awareness grows where you don't have to go, you know, stating the basics anymore.
Exactly. So we go beyond the awareness stage. We actually really are, okay, you know, let's get into solving and where do we put these resources, because we have them already. I think right now we don't have the resources that are needed, both home and abroad. And if we did, that would be great. And, you know, I think that it's very possible.
How much of the 21st century is it going to take to solve the issue of the century?
Oh, I hope less than all the years in a century for it to solve. I really do, but I think it also is very possible. I mean, look at what we did with slavery, obviously it took many, many, many years. But I think that this is an issue that hopefully will be addressed even more so than it is now.
And how much difference can one person make?
One person can make a big difference in another person's life, and I don't think one should think about, it takes a movement to bring about change. It takes lots of people donating a little bit of their time and effort and resources to bring about change. So it's more about, how many people we can bring into this movement and just take a little bit of their effort. I mean, I think that's what it's about.
Cheryl Wudun is the first speaker in this year's Patricia H. Snyder Concert and Lecture Series at the University of Evansville. She's the co-author of Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. And a two-part TV documentary based on the book airs Monday and Tuesday on PBS. And we've got a link to her TED Talk on the Trends Facebook page. Cheryl Wudun, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
A pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I keep using my energy, pushing and shoving my way to peace. Almost there, almost there. Feel like we're getting nowhere. Almost there, almost there.
Support for WNIN comes from the Lang Company, authorized dealer for Konica Minolta office equipment, supplying Konica Minolta color and black and white digital office systems. More product information at 426-1496. And from C&I Electronics, announcing the Vandenberg County Solid Waste District Biannual Electronics Recycle Day, Saturday, September 29th from 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. This event is for Vandenberg County residents and takes place at the Civic Center parking lot. A listing of acceptable items is available on the Vandenberg County Solid Waste District website.
This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer, and we wrap things up with the Arts Notebook. Roger McBain is here from the Courier and Press. Hi, Roger.
Hi.
And Roger, the Evansville Philharmonic Orchestra kicks off its season this weekend.
That's right. Anna Vidovic, a virtuoso classical guitarist from Croatia, is going to join them to play Joaquin Rodrigo's Concerto de Aranjuez on a program of music from and about Spain with music by Manuel de Falla, Emmanuel Chabrier, Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, and Maurice Ravel, whose bolero they're going to play.
And of course, that concerto, even if one doesn't recognize the name, that is the concerto that everyone recognizes the sound of.
Right, right.
Now, you talk about her, you got to talk to her for an article that you wrote in Thursday's paper, and you profiled her background, and it's interesting because it's blues and rock and jazz.
Her father was a pop and rock guitar player, electric guitar, played on a band that worked on cruise ships and things like that before she came along. But when she came along, he had the guitar around, he played, he loved playing jazz and blues records in the house. But she listened to her older brother play Bach and went for Baroque. She began playing classical guitar at 5. She had her first concert at 7, and she was playing internationally at 11. At 13, she was the youngest student ever admitted to the National Music Academy in Zagreb, and that led to her coming here. She went to the Peabody Institute in Baltimore, where she's lived the last 11 years now as a professional, touring, recording, traveling all around the world, doing recitals and concerts.
Wow, and now she's in her very early 30s. What a trajectory.
Yeah.
Now, I think this is interesting because one, pretty regularly hears about rock players, especially progressive rock players, who draw on classical influences. But at least to my knowledge, it doesn't go the other way as often.
Yeah, I haven't heard of it. But she said she loves the blues. She loves Stevie Ray Vaughan. She loves B.B. King. And she has an electric guitar that she plays with for fun. She says maybe she'll do it on stage someday. But at this point, she said she thinks it helps her with her dynamics and phrasing and do things that she didn't do that way before.
Interesting. So the concert is Saturday night, and there's also a free presentation this afternoon, this Friday afternoon.
Right. Her performance is 7 o'clock Saturday night at the Victory. At 2 p.m. today, she's doing an informance, a lecture and demonstration at USI, University of Southern Indiana, second floor reading room of the Rice Library. I'm going to try to get over there for it.
Sounds great. Now, Halloween is right around the corner, which means it's time for our favorite cult film.
Yeah, the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And for years, you know, it's been a staple out at the amphitheater, which has been shut down now this year for safety reasons. So it's moving indoors this year to the Center Exhibition Hall, Rocky Horror Picture Show, with all that comes with that, the campy, kinky, kitschy cross-dressing costume contests. And
now that you should get an award for that alliteration. What's the basic survival kit you've got to have if you go?
Well, I guess flashlights, party hats, playing cards, rice, toast to toss, confetti, rubber gloves, water pistols, not super soakers, and most important of all, a newspaper.
Okay. You're biased.
Keep for your shower, to keep from being showered. That's right. Or you can get a survival kit there for $5 if they don't run out.
And that's at the Civic Center you mentioned.
That's right.
And the University of Southern Indiana is showing what sounds like, you know, at the same time, disturbing but very hopeful drawings.
Rick McCarty was a Vietnam veteran who suffered from post-traumatic stress syndrome ever since the Vietnam War. He turned to sketching to kind of draw out these memories that tormented him and to share those experiences with others. There's an exhibition of his work at the University of Southern Indiana now, some of the drawings that he did. He died at the end of August, but they've extended the show through October. And his work is also in some national archives, and I mentioned links to those in my story that's running Sunday as well.
Great. So that's in Sunday's paper. And really interesting to see how a terrible experience by putting it on paper, it gave him a chance to, I guess, let go of those things.
He tried. You know, I think he remained a tormented man throughout his life, but I think it probably helped.
And finally, at the University of Evansville, a jazz series launches on Sunday.
Jerry Tolson Quintet from Louisville, Kentucky, will play at 4 p.m. Sunday in Wheeler Concert Hall, and that's going to be a tribute to the Cannonball Adderley Quintet, and Cannonball and his brother Nat Adderley. And it's the first of four concerts over the upcoming year. And I mentioned those all in my story. There'll be November, February, March concerts as well.
All in Sunday's paper as well. You can find Roger McBain's articles at CourierPress.com as well. And Roger, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Next week, new visions for Evansville and a new season and new pro hockey league for the Evansville Icemen. Send us your questions and feedback by clicking on the trend at WNIN.org. You'll find links there for getting in touch on Facebook, Twitter, and by email. Weekly podcasts are at our website and at CourierPress.com. You can also catch this show at your convenience by subscribing on iTunes. The Trend is a production of WNIN in collaboration with the Evansville Courier and Press. Ryan Reynolds is our producer at the Courier and Press. Tony Voss is our associate producer. Steve Berger engineered today's show. And this week, Kristen Lund from the University of Evansville gets an honorary producer credit. Our theme music was written by Jeffrey Osman. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We'll talk again next week. This is WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro.